This is the Theology Matters podcast from the Center of Theological Inquiry. I'm Josh Malden, and I'm here with co-host Andrew Davison of the University of Cambridge. And we're here today with a special guest, Hannah Reichel, who's Associate Professor of Reformed Theology at Princeton Theological Seminary. Welcome to the podcast, Hannah, and thanks for being here.
Thanks for having me.
We're here to talk about your recent book, After Method, Queer Grace, Conceptual Design, and the Possibility of Theology, published by Westminster John Knox. It's gotten a lot of attention. I just wanted to read a couple of the blurbs on the back from Vincent Lloyd, who was our last guest on the podcast at the top. He writes, Hannah Reichel has written the best book on theological method in a generation. Ted Smith says, Reichel's book is not just a preface to theology, it's a major theological event in itself. And David Ferguson writes, amongst others, replete with insights, this creative study deserves widespread attention. Lisa Powell writes, few, if any, in the academy today are equipped to engage the range of theological and theoretical interlocutors as Reichel has in this book. We need this book. So congratulations on so much attention you're getting. And maybe just to turn it back right to Andrew to get us started in this conversation. I'll come in a moment.
I want to open on an international angle. I'm sure that everyone who we've interviewed on this series would encourage us to take an international outlook on theology, but I think you've got better firsthand experience than probably anyone we've spoken to so far. Given that this is a podcast series in English on systematic theology, we'd be delighted to hear your perspectives on the shape or character of systematic theology as it might be undertaken in Germany, or maybe I should say in German to include Austrians as well and some Swiss. So we could talk about that on its own terms. I think that's the right way to do it. But then it might be good to think about how it could differ as well from theology in English or in the UK or in England.
Yeah, thank you for this question. And it's in fact very much in the kind of background and origin story of this book as well. So I'm German. I'm from Germany. I received my formal theological education in Germany. At the same time, biographically, my family moved around a lot while I was a kid. And other contexts were also quite formative for me, including for my theological thinking. And in some ways, this book became the moment when I started putting these things together that before then were quite disparate in my own experience, partially because of the particular training that I had received in the German academy. So by and large, systematic theology, as it's taught in German, is, you know, old school in many ways in relation to maybe how theology looks here. And German theologians are still known for this kind of rigor, maybe in some ways the philosophical background, but then also, a proper kind of striving for systematic coherence, or then a kind of historicizing trend that I think has become more pronounced in recent generations. So there's a lot of maybe exegetical and historical types of scholarship going on, and that's very much at the forefront and center of like what academic rigor consists in. And partially you can also explain maybe a certain aversion to more constructive and contextual forms of theology out of obviously the German history. So when I was studying theology, everything that was seen as contextual or political types of theologies immediately had this whiff of this is ideological. When Germans thought of, or maybe still think of, contextual theology, the first thing that comes to mind to them is the German Christians. That's contextual theology. It's the identification of the context and the driving, the contextual concerns of driving kind of the theological agenda. So there's, for good reasons, for really important reasons, really big warning flags against these types of engagements. And then my other part of my own theological, like formative background, was growing up in Latin America, where it was quite the other way around. So a lot of my more implicit formation was in churches that were liberationist and that were very much concerned with a practice first type of approach, and where the good news of the gospel really also had to matter materially in the lives of people and had to not just be up here, but, you know, also reach the ground. And I wasn't really properly able to put these things together because I didn't have the right language for this. And in some weird ways, obviously, the U.S. is its own different context, and it's has its own trajectories in relation to both of these strands and many others. But kind of teaching here at Princeton Theological Seminary and trying to teach a course on theological method and what theology is about. And having students who also pushed me in both of these directions, both coming from kind of backgrounds with strong, rooted faith commitments and trying to spell them out more systematically, and students who are very much coming from activist commitments and interested in making a juster world and having faith be relevant in that sense. Trying to many other kinds of students in between, trying to speak to this audience made me kind of wrestle more with my own different heritages in this regard and trying to put them together. And this is actually how this book came about, almost accidentally.
As I understand it, the German churches are very committed to involvement in the world and the social good and pastoral care. And is the idea of service, of deaconhood, diaconia, is it, is pretty important. If I'm right about that, but you're also saying that contextual theology or the constructive theology, the application of theology, has been a bit suspicious because of the earlier 20th century. Does that mean that those things are both very important in the German context, systematic theology and practical involvement? It's just that they're a little bit dissociated from one another. I mean, am I right that the churches are pretty active in the well-being of the community?
Yes, that is true. And partially, of course, this is also a scene where, at least in Western Germany, the churches are a very important actor in civil society and have developed over, coming out of the Reformation and then also coming out of the kind of Pietist movement, turn to praxis and a turn to involvement in building community, in orientation to social welfare, probably more than justice in kind of a first iteration of those movements, as something that was seen part of an inner mission that then also had material effects. But inner mission, not so much in relation to the spiritual being, but within the church and within communities that were already ostensibly Christian, but whose lives still had to be transformed more thoroughly. And then, of course, there's a development also in the 20th century of a kind of more prophetic witness in relation to political and social ongoings, and that has also immense and also active involvement in ecumenical movements and a kind of strands that continue to draw on that heritage. The church is still a relatively public voice in the German society, and there's a big portion also of the German society that considers the church an important authority on ethical and social matters beyond those who would subscribe, strictly speaking, to the same faith commitments or practice their Christianity in a more active kind of way. So the organized diaconical institutions are actually the second biggest employer in the German state. So right after the state, the second biggest employer, more bigger than any corporation or any other institution, are the so-called diaconical works that organize a lot of a care for the poor, for the needy, for disabled people, for people with mental health and other issues, that have hospitals and schools and so forth. At the same time, obviously, through the crises of moral authority, say, through scandals of sexual abuse, and other things that have come to light increasingly in the Catholic Church and also in the Protestant churches, these moral authorities are also more contested than they used to, and probably rightly so.
But that's maybe floated a little bit free from the systematic theology.
Sorry. Is that
right? Because I think one of the things that's so striking about your book is it's as liberationist as any work of liberation theology, as political as any work of political theology. And yet it's got Barth running right the way through it, Karl Barth, and it's as systematic as any work of systematic theology. It's as interested in doctrine as any work of doctrine. So I really do see these things speaking to one another in your book. And is that something that you'd say you associate with the United States? I mean, one of the ways to put this would be, what would a German theologian get from coming here, and what would someone from over here get from studying for a few years in Germany? What are the best bits, or what would the best be of the influence that might come from either culture?
Yeah, I mean, I would assume that there's also still a variety of different theological cultures alive and well in the United States, but the ones that I primarily move in when I see German colleagues and students coming here, they are often struck by how politicized theology is so how much both political and social questions are at the forefront of theological deliberation and reflection and how much they inform how we think about theology. But also how then a theology immediately allies itself with particular political positions. And while I think, you know, people coming from Germany might see the former as a pronounced strength, they might also have reservations with the latter to some degree. So this might be something that they get here, various ways of integrating these realms more. I think people coming from here to Germany and studying there would probably get a lot of immersion in classical texts and studying texts with a lot of attention to how they're internally organized, how the ideas function, close reading, so to speak, before zooming out to anything else, trying to really work out the internal structure of thought and its own development.
Well, that's really fascinating. And I do think that international dimension, and also, frankly, just looking at theology from the perspective of more than one language, is really important, and a way in which English-speaking theology can be really impoverished. If we move on to your book, I mean, a good way perhaps to introduce it would just be to say, what's the inspiration and, you know, what's it out to do?
Yeah, that's a really good question. So this book happened by accident. I say this in an introduction, and it literally came about this way. I was approached by a journal to write an article on what is the task of theology. And I thought, sure, I can do that. And I started writing, and I had suddenly completed, you know, as I realized that I had completed the first 30,000 of the 5,000 words that I was supposed to write, I realized that this wasn't be able to be contained in an article format, precisely because I started trying to explain myself the things that I hadn't quite gotten around to explain to myself, and then trying to make more sense of them. And in that sense, it's a very systematic endeavor, so to speak. Trying to make more sense and going through the layers of that sense-making enterprise. I ended up writing introductions to my introduction to my introduction, and these ended up spiraling out into chapters. At the same time, I mean, the book is called After Method, and its working title at some point was even Against Method. The intention was really not to try and come to a definitive way of doing theology or to properly define the task of theology as we should now understand it, but partially to grapple with why that is so difficult and what is at stake in doing so. So a certain kind of unease with my different kinds of inheritances that I kind of felt I was carrying around, both drawing on all of them and at the same time also feeling them as quite one-sided and being increasingly frustrated by by kind of their inability to be in constructive conversation with one another. So, right, what I mentioned earlier, the systematic impulse to push contextual, constructive, liberationist theology away as too ideological, and on the other hand, certain liberationist and constructive theological impulses to be hypercritical of anything that is kind of received and inherited theology as kind of probably oppressive and at least questionable in its dominance. I think both of these impulses are right to a certain degree, and I think this is where the conversation should start rather than end. And in that spirit, I wrote the book. And the very much systematic theological paradigm that became helpful for me as a lens to think through this was the threefold use of the law as conceived in the Reform tradition, right? So if we think of method as a kind of law of theology, as the norms and regulation that internal to theology, we might come from where I came biographically from, certain Lutheran sensibilities that see that with a lot of suspicion, and biographically also with increasing kind of queer sensitivities that see all those norms and normativities with suspicion. And at the same time, finding that we don't ever get rid of them. And kind of the crisis through which we go in relation to these norms is maybe an epistemological turning point, but there's a lot of use of the law after grace, and there's a lot of the use of method after kind of coming to what I think theologically is really the problem of justification. And justification, you know, conveniently is a term that applies both in our doctrine of reconciliation and then also in epistemology as a term that we use to justify these endeavors. So I think, yeah, here kind of the theological grammars and structures that I inherited actually became really illuminating and useful in thinking through the shape of the problem of method and why it may not be a problem after all, but yet something that we have to navigate.
That's really fascinating. I think maybe for the sake of unreformed listeners, we should run through the three uses of the law.
Oh, yes. Yeah. Thank you. Obviously. Yeah.
So one of them is, let me think, I can remember. One of them is about causing us to repent. And the other is helping us to live better lives. Is that the third one?
Yes. And the one in between is the very Lutheran one of driving us into despair and showing us how much we need grace. And I think all these three uses of theology, of method and theology might still apply. So there is a use that we could associate with the so-called civil or political use of the law that the theological tradition tells us under conditions of finitude and fallenness, we need to order our being together so that we don't just smash each other's heads in. So there's a use that is geared towards peacekeeping. And that's always a relative endeavor. We can never achieve the eternal, let alone the divine peace of the kingdom of God. But so there is a use to, and I think this applies to method, right? To kind of achieve coherence, to be able to call out what I call bad forms of theology according to different criteria. And one of them might be how much forms of theology that we've come up with do harm in the world. That might be actually a good criterion to critique them and to say on methodological grounds to try and rein them in and to improve them, knowing that we cannot come up with a perfect or good type of theology this way, but at least to kind of mitigate and minimize particularly bad forms of theology. So that might be one use. And then there's a second use of method where it actually ends in frustration, right? If we try to come up, and this is the old Lutheran dilemma of the attempt to achieve righteousness on our own terms, to come up with a better method and a better practice and a more rigorous approach and discipline ourselves even more. And at some point, then we must surely get it right. And we just find that we never do. And I spell this out. And I think this is actually it's very frustrating, but it might also be a useful thing that, you know, leads us to greater humility in terms of what we might be able to do with our theology and our trying to get it right. That might actually also be conducive to limiting some of the dangers and our own triumphalism in it. And to chasten, right, some of these aspirations, but that also then have to keep us on our feet. And the third use of the law is in the Reformed tradition, the use in Renatus, in those who are already reborn, who do good works, not out of a sense of trying to achieve our righteousness, but simply out of gratitude, not because God needs them, but because they're still useful for our neighbor. And so kind of a turn from this pursuit of righteousness to works of care and love.
So it's one of the things that comes out of your book is it's quite a bracing read, you know, is this sense of responsibility, the theologian mm-hmm. taking responsibility for what they write. And you'll sense that, I want to put words in your mouth, but, you know, if someone makes chairs with sharp edges, and then lots of children get hurt with the chairs, the manufacturer of the chairs can't say, oh, well, they should have just taken more care of the sharp edges. One has a responsibility for the things that one puts out in the world. And that really comes across in your book. That it's a very biblical idea. I was thinking of the New Testament idea that those who teach will be judged more severely, and judgment begins with the household of God. You know, that the one really does need to think about what might be done with the things that you write. That seems like an important part of the book.
So I do think that as those who produce theological texts or design theological ideas or tinker with them and write about them, we have a certain kind of responsibility to also think about how they might be put to use. The other big move, and maybe we can talk about this in a second, is that I also want to kind of come to a more multifactorial and multi-stakeholder account. But I still think that as those of us who are kind of professionally tasked with doing theology and teaching theology and casting and framing these ideas in particular ways, we should take responsibility to some extent to how these are used. And so this is my invitation to, for example, systematic theologians to also take more seriously certain kinds of critiques that we've heard and to say these should matter to us on our own terms as part of what we do and not just as, say, misapplication or misuse. If, for example, womanist theologians tell us that our atonement theologies actually do not afford them comfort but have exacerbated their suffering through advocating for self-sacrificial kinds of spiritualities and practices, then systematic theologians have tended to say, right, this is not how we intend these to be used. But then the question is, where does the fault lie, right? So first is maybe an important consideration to say, maybe this is not about blame and only about intent, but if we want to identify in this process where things go wrong, where could things go better, right? And could there be a consideration of those who shape these ideas into in particular ways to say, okay, if repeatedly and recurrently people use them in this direction, could I frame it differently to avoid that type of use if that is actually not my intention? And so this is something that I pick up from design theory. And there's you've invoked the example of the chairs already. A very famous example is the so-called Norman door, right? If a door kind of, and we've probably all had this experience that we run into a door and we intend to open it and it actually opens into our face. So we kind of smash into it. And then we feel, you know, completely hit over the head by it. And if that happens, well, maybe we just pay attention to the sign on the door that says pull rather than push. But if that happens all the time, again, maybe the door is also communicating something that we pick up well and really understand well. And the designer just didn't understand that putting a sign that says pull is not an efficient way of communicating. And instead, they should, you know, install a different kind of handle to visually and more quickly and more effectively convey how the door should be used if this is how it tends to be used. And that would minimize, you know, this stupefying effect on people that just intend to get through the door.
So my invocation of the responsibility of the theologian is kind of right, but also half wrong, because I might be putting too much emphasis on the role of the theologian. I mean, it's partly about us doing a better job as theologians, but also about not thinking that we're absolutely at the center of everything.
Yeah, we're just one actor in this whole scheme, right? One of the other things that I think design theory invites us to do is to take the materiality that is already given and that precedes us seriously. And I think as theologians, we tend to do this, right? We tend to work with texts that we've inherited, with concepts and ideas that we have inherited, and that cannot be shaped just any given way. And part of these commitments we can think of as in very material senses as tracking with institutions and faith practices and ways that people move in the world. And partially these are kind of conceptual affordances or theological commitments that we just don't want to relinquish or want to remain faithful to. And then most of the ways that theology becomes relevant is not in academic discussions. It's in the church, it's in the world, it's in the lives of people. And the theologians often, and I mean, I think this is where maybe they compare well to the role of designer, is not because they're the supreme authority, but mostly because they kind of tend to enter the scene when things don't work automatically. So mostly theology gets produced in the lives of people and in the practices of the church. And theologians reflect on them specifically when they try to test if this is the best way to do things or if this is actually faithful to the kinds of commitments that we intend to honor with them, and or when we find that this doesn't happen and there's a need to reshape them. So it's kind of a second order reflection, and it's a second order type of intervention that is not the primary practice of faith and that can play a critical role.
Presumably, as well as unexpected harms, there may well be ways in which theology does unexpected good.
Yes.
And we should attend to that as well.
Of course, yeah. And I know you have pushed me on that in a different contribution. So I invite readers also to read the upcoming Syndicate Symposium on the book, in which Andrew Davidson pushes me significantly on the more positive uses of theology and rather than just a negative bends.
Can I throw in a bit here about, you kind of passed over, and I know one of your questions coming up, Andrew, is going to be about other theologians besides Bart who might, you know, what their role might be. I was thinking, I like the use of Bart in this book because I find Bart to be, Karl Barth, to be ambivalent about the term systematic theology. He, in various places, he likes to critique it.
Yeah.
You know, he associates it with someone like Paul Tillich. He says in this little book, Evangelical Theology, something like systematic theology, I tried to find it this morning, but he says basically systematic theology is a contradiction in terms. Theology can't be completed, enclosed, foreclosed, something like that, he says. So I think it works well to bring him in, but I don't know what you think about. But to put it as a question, you know, is Bart actually a good example of systematic theology, or is he almost an alternative to it?
Yeah, I mean, I really like Bart for the same reason here. Yeah. Because I think he, in certain, so he comes out of this tradition, obviously, and embodies it to certain extents. And I think he's often more systematic than he presents himself,
yeah,
which is sure. Also one of his strengths. Yeah. But he's kind of on the other side of a certain critique of systematic theology that we, you know, there, and obviously there's lots of discussions on Bart, and there are people who want to see him as an almost pre-modern thinker who's uncritical and, you know, is still committed to all these things that maybe we should question more. But I think he's better perceived as kind of a post-critical theologian. And you know, he frames himself as an unsystematic, systematic theologian. He's very wary, not just of the epistemological limitations of the possibility of achieving a system, but also of the theological reasons why we maybe shouldn't try to, right? So there's an attempt to maybe achieve a certain kind of mastery over God or over divine things that we should maybe not indulge in all the way. And so one of the things that I find so useful and fruitful in Bart is that he gives you a little bit of both, right? So he in many ways is very systematic. I mean, the sheer beauty and architectural coherence of his work is often stupendous and astounding. And then you can also see that a lot of this goes back to very few what we might call theological axioms. He even talks about axioms himself in a particular context that is actually highly politically charged, right? When he talks about the first commandment as the axiom for theology in the context of the rise of the Third Reich. The first commandment, God is God, you shall have no other gods. The Christocentrism of his thought, the time and again lifting up of the word of God as the only source of theology, but then relativizing between the scripture. There's no behind scripture, there's no truth beyond scripture that we can reconstruct, but it's also not just scriptural proof texting, so it becomes more complicated. But so basically, you know, you can work, you can... There's like a Bartian machine that you can crank up and then apply to almost any problem with very few base theological commitments that are highly resonant with very, very broad strands of Christian tradition, obviously broadly Protestant, but also beyond Protestantism. And I think this is one of the reasons why his thought has also appealed to many. I still find that often Bart can be a kind of gateway drug for people who come out of more... conservative theological traditions, precisely because of these Christological and biblical commitments. Mm. But then the way he uses them is so highly critical and also including, right, the self-criticism that he uses them for, to kind of challenge the work of the theologian time and again as fraught with theological hubris, as having to negate itself time and again. So that allows for kind of doing both, right? Both a very unapologetic theological theology that doesn't take its justification from a philosophical system or anything like that. But at the same time, this willingness to start over and again and being corrected and living from presuppositions that you do not give yourself, but that you take from revelation, from the existence of the church and its proclamation, and then humbly, just secondarily kind of reflecting on that. I also want to say that I don't want to unduly hype Bart. I don't think he's like the one and only theologian or we all need to be Bartians. Obviously, he also has severe limitations and they have been worked out really well by a lot of scholarship. I personally always have two major voices in my ear when I think of critiques of Bart. One is my mother, who's a pastor. And when I started doing my dissertation on Bart and told her that I was reading Bart, she said, "Are people still reading Bart?" And it was like with this deep sense of almost loathing or frustration and weariness in her voice, coming out, I think, of a context in which Bartian theology had become really dominant also in kind of post-war Germany and in practical and ecclesial uses. I think there's a version of Bart's thought that, or let me phrase it like this. I think Bart's theology is really, really powerful, asserted against or in complement to kind of as a critique of and as a supplement of and as a as maybe a remediation of kind of ways of doing theology. And it becomes almost unbearable when it becomes itself the dominant theology. It becomes very triumphalist, very righteous. And I think, right, this frustration that I sense in my mother's voice comes out of this experience. And the other voice, which is an academic voice that I have heard this from afterwards, is James Cone's critique. Who, right, is trained in Bart's thought and thinks about it a lot and then comes to the conclusion that this is a theology that is really, can be a really powerful theology kind of against oppressors, but it does very little as a kind of emancipatory and liberative theology for those who have been oppressed. And the same theology of revelation can function very differently, speaking to these different interlocutors. And that was really convincing to me. So in that sense, I think Bartian theology should also be handled with care and contextualized itself. And in some ways, I think maybe this hypercritical line in it might actually still have its greatest time to come. But I would never want it to be the sole voice in theology.
If we think about the second half of the 20th century, maybe even later, there was this wonderful program of translating a lot of German theology into English. And so what was happening in Germany didn't lag very far behind what was appearing in British American classrooms. And it seems to me that that project has largely dried up. So we're probably not aware, unless we're German speakers, readers, of what's going on in Germany. And given your Latin American experience, maybe we should bring in Spanish language theology as well. Who do you think that we're missing who's writing in German or potentially in Spanish?
So I think there are a lot of German theologians who have started writing in English or who have been in the second half of the 20th century, as you have mentioned, have been translated, right? And I'm thinking of voices like Bonhoeffer or Moltmann or someone who has also been formative for me, Michael Welker, who have kind of appeared on the more international scene. There's also the reverse effect, I think, to what you describe. I think there's also a lot of German-speaking theology going on in almost obliviousness to the rest of the world around them, still kind of conceiving of Germany as kind of the pinnacle of theological achievement and thought, and as if we don't have to take into consideration things that are happening elsewhere in the world. And I don't want to also throw too much shade on that. I just personally have tended to zoom out of the German scene more than into it, maybe partially because what I described earlier, that I find most contemporary German-speaking theology to be mostly reconstructive, often exegetical, rather than be really constructively concerned with burning questions, at least to me, and not to say that those don't exist. And maybe this frustration that also comes through in the book, that often over-obsessed with kind of a methodological rigor rather than a courage to actually do theology. And I have since found more kind of surprising dialogue partners, not just outside of the German academic theological scene, but also out of the discipline of theology proper, often finding that many of the pockets of critical discourse that would probably not self-identify as theological, let alone kind of Christian in a confessional or committed sense, are asking deeply theological questions and often parsing them out in ways that are really resonant with, I think, theological insights. And that has tended to fascinate me more in these past few years.
That might be a good transition point to point out that your book, After Theory, is a conversation between Bart and queer theology, which I suppose draws from a broader sense of queer theory. That might be a relatively unfamiliar tradition to some listeners. It's a relatively recent named approach to theology. Can you introduce the perspective, or maybe I should say perspectives, that might represent a queer theological approach, and tell us why you think it's important to the contemporary theological scene to pay attention to it?
Yeah, sure. And when we say queer theology, I would say there are at least maybe two broad strands that might be worth distinguishing. So one is a kind of LGBTQIA plus affirming theology. And obviously this is a very important project and one that often has come out of different feminist movements to kind of expand conversations about gender and sexuality and gendered and sex experience both in, you know, for people who have experienced discrimination in the church or who have experienced themselves as othered by particular theological frameworks and are articulating this experience and trying to reformulate theology and their own theological and religious commitments in a way that both articulates their experience and is more hospitable to it. And this is obviously, so it's a very, very important enterprise. And then there's queer theory that, or theologies that draw more heavily on queer theory. Obviously, queer theory is a strand of reflection that also builds on gendered and sex experience, but often from there kind of gets to critique norms and normative frameworks more broadly and the way language functions and the way the self is constituted, building on particularly particular form of LGBTQIA experience. But then carrying this critique, right, or carrying this reflection to a critique of normative frameworks or of ways that identity get constructed often in practice conflicts with the more affirming types of theologies that try to advocate for the participation and inclusion and so forth of particular experiences, or better said, better put, people, whereas queer theory tends to be critical of those frameworks that are used for this type of integration into frameworks that are then perceived to be normative and identitarian again. On the other hand, queer theory is also not simply anti-normative. I think it develops some of the most sophisticated ways of thinking about how norms are both socially produced and then produce us in kind of recursive frameworks, and how language functions and how the self functions in social arrangements, and develops a certain kind of hypercritical epistemology out of this that is driven by concerns for justice and for truth, broadly speaking, right? But doesn't arrive at a simple political program. And I think in that sense, it's very resonant with theological impetus, right? It's the same, or this is kind of the ground on which I try to bring the two together, this sensitivity to realities that exceed any capturing by language and by norms, and the ways that should also make us cautious to attempt to do this conclusively, driven out of a greater concern for truth and justice rather than just an attempt to tear everything down.
I was going to say, we've got one example of an insight from Bart, which is not thinking that we can put God in a box and sort everything out and control things, what would the main insight be from queer theory? But actually, what you've just said seems to me like you're showing the real convergence of insights there. There's a similar concern not to think that we've mastered our topic and got everything under control. And that's, those two voices are actually, from Barthes and queer theory, quite similar. If there was one other thing that someone might take away from your book, perhaps as a theologian or as someone who reads a lot of theology, that would inform the way they think from this, maybe the second part of the queer theory, queer theology, what would you point to?
Yeah, I mean, the convergence between the God cannot be put in a box and people cannot be put in boxes is very strong in the strand of queer theology that I work with. So the theologian I'm engaging here is Marcela Altos Reed, an Argentinian theologian who then later taught in Scotland. And she comes to this conclusion, right, that God is, or that queerness at the end of the day is divine, and that also people are queer by divine grace, and that therefore, right, they will always exceed our social arrangements and our linguistic frameworks and so forth, and therefore need to be liberated time and again from them. But this can kind of put us on a more open and joyful and wider plane rather than merely a critical and kind of paranoid trying to undo the harm and the limitations. And I think, I mean, there would be a lot to say about the, like, that theologically. The more humble note on which I end is, again, about the task of doing theology, where I try to read the theological commitments and the queer commitments and then these insights from design theory together to say, maybe it would be worth trying to, rather than come up with the right method and so forth, to kind of more loosely hold these different things together and maybe slightly more playfully and joyfully and openly continue to work with them. Right. So from design theory, we might say all the theological puzzles to which we're trying to conceptualize solutions are wicked problems. By this, we mean they don't have just the one solution in any straightforward way, but rather than cause despair, this could also invite us to a more relaxed working with them, that where we can learn from different methodological paradigms and come up with a more capacious way of thinking about them. That is both more rigorous and more critical because it actually has to take many, many more factors into consideration, but doesn't need to be only about despair. It is actually fueled, right, by this greater joy and this greater grace that it's trying to tap into and out to.
Because there might be a sort of boundlessness of treasure within these things. That's another reason that we can't just fix on this or that. There's a sort of depth to the ideas we're talking about and a depth to the realities that we're talking about and to people.
We usually close with a kind of short questions, which we haven't prepped you for, but we'll just throw these at you. and the first one is, what theology book most influenced you? And I thought of a qualification to that. It's not what theology book you wish had most influenced you early on, but which one actually did, which may not be the same thing.
It should be an actual theology book. Then it was Augustine's Confessions. It was one of the first like actual theology books that I read that completely blew my mind.
Okay. And what book most influenced you theologically, we might say, which may not be a theology book, if it's something else than that?
So one that is not a theology book and that did influence me theologically, and I only learned to put theological language to that later, is Max Frisch, who's a post-war German author. And the book is called Stiller. And it literally starts with the sentence, "I am not Stiller." And it's this narration of this guy who comes home and gets apprehended and even arrested because and just insists that he's not the person that they take him to be. And so it's this complicated investigation of what it actually means to be identical with yourself and your past and people's perception of you that he works through in a lot of different of his novels and works, and how... Yeah, So this was, in a certain sense, kind of pre-theological and pre-queer, and then later resonated with many of the things that I picked up from these discourses.
And if you come across a student who's really starting out in theology, I mean, maybe they've done some studies, but this is going to be their first work of theology they read, what would you recommend them?
Who's the student?
I don't have a name for one, but...
We could turn that question back and say... Yeah. That suggests that there's at least a bifurcation, or you think it's important to recommend different sorts of books for different people.
And, I think so,
and what,
yeah.
What lies behind that? What insight does that unveil?
So let me invoke a pious painting in this case, right? Matthias Grünewald's Isenheim altarpiece that Bart also was very fond of talking about. And in this piece, we see Christ crucified in a really gruesome way. That's not quite my point here. But what Bart says about the piece is you see John the Baptist at that scene pointing at Christ. And he says all that theology does is, or, you know, all that you should aspire to is be that index finger that points to Christ. And I take this to mean, and maybe this slight beyond Bart, is like you gain very little from studying that index finger in great detail, right? You have to follow the movement. That's also very, especially early Bartian sentiment. But if you just take that index finger, you will learn nothing about who God is. And I think this can happen with the best types of theological writing that we take. If we just study them in and of itself without kind of trying to follow what they point to, or we take them out of context, they might actually point to something very, very different. And depending on where you are in that scene, right, the pointing would have to go a different way. And I think that is, so this is why I hesitate. I don't think there's like the one generic book. If we all read it, then we would be better Christians or better theologians. Actually, this is one of the major things that I've developed together with a colleague, Dirk Smet, to whom I'm really indebted in this regard, for this course that we try to come up with, is to say, rather than, you know, try and teach students these are the classical texts and the classical positions they have to learn, we want them to learn to kind of perambulate in a theological library and to orient themselves and to kind of see here are these different conversations that are going on. And depending on where you come from, you will have to take different inroads to, you know, to point that direction. Well, there may still be, right? Like there might be a center, and sometimes the center is decentered, but whatever that you try to point to. I'm not trying to evade your question, actually. I don't have the one generic book that I would recommend.
And this is not an alternative on that question. This next one, I actually consider this to be a different question, and I take your point. Exactly. Making a syllabus for a class, I assume much of the time, at least, you don't actually know who the students are. Would there be a particular book for an introduction to theology class that you think would be especially appropriate, if not necessary, to include? I assume you make the syllabus before the students show up and talk about what they prefer and so on.
We do, yeah. So we try to also at least give them different orientation. So we also read Bart's Evangelical Theology with them as a possible inroad. And we invite them to read James Cone and Dolores Williams and Marcella Althusser to grapple with theology from very different perspectives. We invite them to read classical texts like the Luther's Heidelberg Disputation to talk about the theology of the cross, as well as Moltmann or John Sobrino, so that they kind of can have layers in their engagement.
Maybe as a final question, what's been some of the... responses so far to the book, and maybe totally unrelated, but similar question is, how did your students at PTS kind of influence the writing of this book?
Yeah, so this is one of my embarrassments, that my students were probably of more use to me than I was or am able to be for them here, because I feel like they really helped me to process some of these thoughts, and then I pour them out into a kind of writing that is, with, in my own estimation, rather inaccessible to a broader and less an audience that hasn't read all the things that I have read. I'm just trying to work out something for myself here. But my two favorite responses that I have received, or the ones that have, you know, been the biggest blessing for me. One was when some people have praised my writing, and that was so partially because I think all of this is very abstract and completely inaccessible. And also because this is not even my first language. So some people have told me that some of these parts saying that just has, you know, been very gratifying to me. But my favorite response has been the graduate student who comes and told me, this book has given me license to do the things that I need to do. And so, right, I consider this part of a conversation. I don't know if I believe half of what I write in there, but if it can spark responses for people to engage differently in the things that they want to do, and if it gives them some tools to do that better, and maybe, right, this is, if it can have some use in this sense as a stepping stone that maybe they throw away and leave behind, or also fight back fervently against, then that's yeah, the best thing that can happen.
Well, with that, we want to thank you for being on the podcast and for discussing your recent, very interesting book, After Method, published by Westminster John Knox. So thank you so much, Hannah.
Thank you.
Thank you.